Christopher Cruz, a huge hospital in Gaza City is mostly empty this morning after most patients, doctors, and nurses evacuated the complex. CBS's Doug Williams in Tel Aviv says there's a dispute about why.
Estimated about 18,000 people in Al Shifa Hospital, some wounded, some using it as shelter, and the displaced. But they're leaving. And the reason why is another example this morning of the information war going on. This morning, hospital officials and the Hamas-run health ministry have reported that the IDF forced the hospital to be evacuated. About an hour and 40 minutes later, we received a statement from an IDF spokesperson that the evacuation was simply granting a request of the hospital director to let people evacuate.
A judge says former President Trump's name can appear on the state's presidential primary ballot. More on that from CBS's Michelle Miller.
A Denver District Court judge said Trump engaged in insurrection in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, but she ruled that Friday that it's unclear if part of the Constitution's 14th Amendment, which forbids someone from holding office if they engage in an insurrection or rebellion, applies to the presidency.
It'll be mostly smooth sailing for Thanksgiving holiday travelers, says National Weather Service lead forecaster Bob Orovec.
As we get into the holiday, especially on Thanksgiving, it looks like it's going to be relatively cool across a good part of the country, especially east of the Rockies. We do anticipate temperatures to be below average. Above average temperatures are going to be from the Rockies westward to the West Coast.
But freezing rain and heavy snow could start Wednesday in upstate New York and continue on Thanksgiving Day. The hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs and his former longtime girlfriend, singer Cassandra Cassie Ventura, have settled a federal lawsuit the day after she filed it. CBS's Jeff Glor with details.
On Thursday, Combs' attorney denied the allegations and claimed Cassie had attempted to blackmail the entertainer for $30 million. Cassie denied blackmailing claims. In a statement released Friday, Cassie said she has resolved the matter amicably on terms that she has some level of control. Combs also released a statement in part saying he wished Cassie and her family the best.
Ventura had accused Combs of rape, physical abuse, and sex trafficking. Veterinary labs in Oregon, Colorado, and New Hampshire are investigating an unusual respiratory illness in dogs that doesn't respond to antibiotics. Symptoms include coughing, sneezing, nasal or eye discharge, and lethargy. Veterans are encouraging pet owners to have their dogs have less contact with other dogs. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
Pluto TV is your home.
What really prompted me to call is how respectful and willing to listen you are. We are human beings. People have their beliefs for a whole lot of reasons, some of them rational, maybe some of them not.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate the call, Stephanie. Look, we just...
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Plans to expand part of Interstate 94 in Milwaukee are reigniting a debate over the environment. Mike Mohn has more on a new study that suggests narrower traffic lanes could lessen the environmental impact of new road projects.
Research from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health was more focused on urban roadways with speed limits of around 35 miles an hour. Dr. Shima Hamidi helped lead the study, which says switching from lane widths between 12 and 11 feet, long the norm, down to 9 feet helps reduce traffic collisions. She says it also leaves more room for options that don't involve vehicles.
It also will help many people to switch from driving to other modes of transportation, such as biking and walking, which could result in greenhouse gas emission reductions from transportation.
The study notes that with narrower lanes, people won't feel compelled to drive as fast and will be more alert. Hamidi says while this approach might slow traffic, past research shows minimal effects. That means these changes wouldn't cancel out environmental benefits. Hamidi also notes that transportation planners and engineers have expressed liability concerns, but she says her team's study is one of the first to give cities and states firm data on the traffic safety side, showing that skinnier lanes are more effective.
We are getting more and more interest from transportation planners, mostly at the local level. Cities are eager and interested to really see how this could be implemented.
Hamidi says the next steps involve more research to quantify some of the other impacts, including air pollution. The study issued this month analyzed nearly 1,200 streets in seven cities around the U.S. The findings come amid a gradual increase in pedestrian fatalities over the past decade. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman for today. Sunshine and a high near 52. Mostly clear tonight, 27. Sunny with a high near 50 on your Sunday. For Monday, a chance of rain with a high around 45. For Tuesday, a chance of rain, breezy, with a high around 39.
Currently 33 degrees.
On air, 93.5 FM. Online, thetap.com. And on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to our Saturday morning broadcast. It is Saturday, November 18th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel. Delighted to have you with me and my wonderful producer, Anya, both this hour and next hour. This is, as always, our weekly review, our analysis, and our discussion involving you as well in the most important news events, the issues, the stories of our days in the areas of law and government, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in America. I am supported and assisted, as always, by my extraordinary producer here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha. Right here, Anya is my producer, and together we are delighted, we are honored to have you with us for our broadcast this morning and also every Saturday morning in this time slot. The stations of Civic Media, not only in Waukesha, where we're broadcasting from the studios of WAUK, but also other wonderful stations of Civic Media throughout this terrific state of Wisconsin. Let me tell you who you are and where you are. You're WMDX in Madison. That's WXCO in Wausau. That's WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids. WRCE in Richland Center. WLAK in Amory. WISS in Oshkosh, WGBW in Green Bay, WBZH in Hayward, WRJN in Racine, WLCX in La Crosse, and yes, W228EP, The Tap, 93.5 in the beautiful area of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Delighted to have all of you listening from those stations of Civic Media throughout this state of Wisconsin joining us this morning for our broadcast. As always, focusing, as we do, on law, government, and justice in America, and encouraging, as always, your comments, your questions, your perspectives, especially your inquiries about things we're talking about this morning. That phone number, call in, speak to us, speak to Anya, speak to me at 844-967-2789. That phone number once more, 844-967-2789. You can also go very easily, perhaps just as easily as getting on your cell phone. You can also go to the Civic Media website. That's on your broadcast station. Find it there. Pull down the folder called Morning Cannoli, and there you'll be able to access us through the typewritten format. Send me a note, send me a message, especially appreciating and reveling in your questions every single Saturday morning. They're always wonderful. They're always good. We value diversity. We value a lots of different expression here on our morning broadcast, and we will stay true to that commitment this morning and future mornings as well. This morning, this is our 72nd broadcast since going on the air in June of 2022. Again, delighted to have you with me and with Anya this morning. As always, we ask and attempt to answer as best we can three important questions. Number one, what happened? What are those significant news events, those stories of the week that animate our lives and our livelihoods here in the United States of America, here in the state of Wisconsin, and also around the world? We've got some international perspectives on the rule of law this morning as well to talk about what are the facts? What do we know about what's going on out there in our world, our nation, and our state? Second, why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material, significant to our lives? Why should we be concerned and focused on those things? And third, in many instances, not all, but many instances, what should we do? What can we do? What are options out there for activities, responses, answers, actions that we can take that will promote not only a better society for all of us here in the state of Wisconsin, throughout our nation, but across the face of this planet? Those questions, what happened? Why are they important? And what should we do about those important issues in our lives? All of that being a part of our agenda this morning as well. It is, as always, ambitious but achievable, hopefully for you and for all of us here on our morning broadcast, informative, educational, maybe even inspiring, maybe even motivating along the way as we go to our syllabus. What kinds of things are going to be on our academic agenda this morning, engaging you in conversation as always? It is a lot, but a lot of things happening this past week. You know about many, if not all of them. We're going to begin with some perspectives, exactly the spot where we left last Saturday, talking about the budget in America. We know that there is some significant news coming out of Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives and the United States Senate agreeing this past week to put together, yes, yet another stopgap measure, not a true budget, but a stopgap measure that keeps us in business, keeps the government doors open and operating for about another 2 months or so, approximately into mid-January of the next year, kicking this can once again down the street. We're going to talk about the practical implications of that decision and the failure of our government to have a routine agenda when it comes to our fiscal future. We're going to talk with particularity, we're talking about January 6th, the impact that this kind of thing has on the capacity of, yes, the Department of Justice to act on your behalf, to provide service to you in enforcing the law and ensuring civil rights are promoted. We're going to talk about that in connection with the ongoing investigations of January 6th, the impact that this recent decision had upon that particular major initiative of the U.S. Department of Justice. And we're going to go overseas to the continent of Africa, rule of law there as well. Also, some lessons to be pulled from the continent of Africa. Two countries in particular in the news this past week, Rwanda, and a particular decision made by the British Supreme Court related to a proposal by the Conservative majority in Parliament just this past week, a major case involving asylum seekers in, yes, that's right, Great Britain and the nation of Rwanda. Second, Zimbabwe, also in South Central African continent, going to talk about some serious concerns, some civil rights concerns there in the nation, being visited upon the opponents of the recently elected government in that African nation. Then coming back home to the United States of America, we're going to talk about at least two major cases in the courts of our land just this past week. One of them involving the conviction of the attacker of Paul Pelosi. I'm going to talk about what that was all about, some of the takeaways, some lessons from that particular conviction, that judgment returned by a jury just this past week, and also another jury decision in connection with a criminal prosecution against one of the officers involved in the shooting, the catastrophic shooting that resulted in the death of Breonna Taylor. You remember her well. We're going to talk about that particular case, the result there, and what's going to happen in the future, not only with respect to the particular officer who, yes, was mistried basically in the case this past week because the jury could not reach a verdict in that matter. What does the future hold in terms of the prosecution of him by the federal government, by the United States Department of Justice, under a civil rights criminal conspiracy? Then we're going to chat again, as we've talked at great length in the past, about January 6th. A couple of important cases coming out of the January 6th matter, including one of them having to do with the QAnon shaman. Remember him? The visual, very, very striking individual with the horns and the other regalia that he brought into the Capitol on that day. We're going to talk about something that brought him back into the news this past week. In addition, the horrific, the violent, the human tragedy death of Ashley Babbitt on January 6th. We're going to talk about something that happened in connection with her death and the prosecution of a person involved in that incident on the day, talking about whether or not he was an activist involved in the process that day of attacking the Capitol, or was he a journalist, and some of the discussion, some of the challenge around that. We're necessarily going to be chatting, of course, about the cases pending in court as well. We know about the January 6th major insurrection, the attempt to undermine, to stop the voting, the Electoral College voting on Capitol Hill on January 6th. Judge Chutkan, Tanya Chutkan, continuing to supervise and manage a case that she has scheduled for early 2024. Some major decisions coming out of her bench, coming out of her chambers just late this past week. I'm going to talk about what that means for the future of that case. I'm going to talk also about the Georgia case, that being prosecuted by Fani Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County. A couple of important things, serious things happening in that case. Some leaks of the tapes of the cooperating former defendants now providing testimony and information to the government. I'm going to talk about the implications of that, the reasons why this is so catastrophic for the prosecution, the litigation, the delivery of justice in that case when things of this sort are undertaken. Yes, in this case, by defense counsel, leaking discovery provided to him and his attorney as a part of the routine process there. We're also going to talk about the attempt, the motion recently filed by Fani Willis, the prosecutor there, to seek the revocation of the bond, the release of one of those defendants. His name is Harrison Floyd, for violating some of the basic terms and conditions upon which he was released after his indictment, among 18 others, a 19-defendant indictment altogether. I want to talk about the reasons for Fani Willis seeking to send him back to jail, back to prison, awaiting trial, now probably scheduled, maybe, possibly, if Fani Willis gets her way, for sometime in August of 2024, not only in the midst of the 2024 presidential election, but right in the midst of those conventions, weeks before the general election in November of next year. And then finally, as we're always doing, we're going to talk this segment and in future segments about the Supreme Court. A couple of very important things happening in the United States Supreme Court. Just this past week, once again, we have chatted at great length about this need for an ethics code, a code of conduct to regulate, to oversee, to administer the work, and specifically the recusals, the conduct, the receipt of monies, the income by sitting Supreme Court justices. Something big happened on Monday of this past week. The Supreme Court issued a document, arguably, we'll talk about that, arguably in response to the furor, the uproar about the lack of a code of ethics. The Supreme Court arguably responding to that need by issuing a document. We'll talk about the content of that. And along the way, we're going to talk as well about another major set of cases now pending before the United States Supreme Court, about 44 of them already on the docket of the Supreme Court. These particular cases having to do with a challenge to, even an attack, according to some people, on our administrative agencies, civil servants doing their job inside federal administrative agencies. When we come back right after this initial presentation, we're going to launch right into that discussion. Stay with us for all of that, beginning with the United States Congress and the budget arguably put together just this past week.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
I'm not even clear from conflicting headlines whether or not Robin Voss has the cojones to move forward with impeachment against Megan Mullen. Why would he do such a thing? You know, just a couple of weeks after he said he wasn't going to do such a thing. Well, he's been threatened, huh? By what? A group headed by his primary opponent, Adam Steed.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. Okay.
We are back. This is our Saturday morning broadcast talking about law and government and justice in America. As promised, let's launch that discussion. Also inviting you to our discussion by calling me and calling Anya at 844-967-2789 or going on the Civic Media website, pulling down your broadcast station, finding the Morning Cannoli folder and sending us a note, specifically a question. Always appreciate and value questions about things that are on our agenda this morning, beginning again on our syllabus with this important news that, yes, this morning, the United States government, the strongest, biggest, largest, most important government, I would argue, on the face of the planet, is still in operation. It is stunning even to say those kinds of things because it should not be. Plainly, the Constitution, as we contemplated, as we talked last time at the end of our broadcast, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, invests in the United States Congress, the House of Representatives in particular, the express responsibility for doing what? For keeping us in business, for keeping the lights on, for keeping the doors open. And that is the power to not only lay and collect taxes, impose excises and import regulations, but also to pass a budget. It says no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. That, appropriately interpreted throughout our nation's history, is requiring the Congress to put together an annual budget. All sorts of statutes enacted pursuant to that, including a thing called the Budget and Accounting Act, another thing called the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act, those back in the 1920s and 1970s in particular, respectively. All of that imposing upon our House of Representatives and thus the United States Senate, and yes, indeed, the President of the United States of America to ensure that there is a budget to ensure operations of our government, ensuring that our agencies are funded, that good and decent and hardworking civil servants, not just political appointees, not just the people elected to Congress and other positions of responsibility, that all those people who keep our government operating day to day, we benefit from the services they provide in ways known and unknown, that all of them are supported. This past week, we once again averted the latest near miss, if you will, in terms of stopping that budget from being in place. I have bemoaned the fact that we have not had a budget for decades, a real budget, and instead we continue to pass these continuing resolutions, sometimes called stopgap measures, and indeed this one put together, yes, by newly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives. His name again is Mike Johnson. He's a Republican from Louisiana. He is now in charge of the House of Representatives, the majority, a slim majority of his party in the House of Representatives. And sure enough, he had to rely upon government involvement of all parties, not only his party, but the Democrats as well, to pass that stopgap measure on the Senate side of the House, a little bit less drama. They have put together, likewise, a plan to keep us afloat until when? Until mid-January of 2025, just a few weeks down the road, not passing again, consistent with the Constitution, the budget that's contemplated by that document, but waiting again so we can go through this process yet again, another review, another analysis, another attempt to keep the government afloat. So why is this such a big deal? Well, maybe people's eyes will glaze over. This sounds like, yes, just the latest in the series of these kinds of events, but it's more than that. It really does have a dramatic impact. As I have explained before, in my 30 years or so as not only a government employee, but 6.5 years of those as the U.S. Attorney, the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Chief Federal Law Enforcement Officer for this part of the state, this part of the country, obliged to ensure that arrangements are made long in advance of a shutdown for coverage so that we don't completely shut down and so that there is a response of law enforcement and security and safety on behalf of the people of this district, as do all other U.S. attorneys around the country. Every single time there is a threat, a concern about a government shutdown, before that is resolved, as it was yet again this past week, every single time there are expenditures of resources, time, attention, focus, industry, all those kinds of things by elected and appointed and civil servants around the country focusing on how do we keep the government operational? What do we do to ensure that we are running still in the midst of this nearly complete shutdown? And yes, indeed, there are mechanisms for stopgap measures even while the government is not funded. This takes an awful lot of time and resources. And yes, I know well that now there's a notebook in every single government office around the country. We take it off the shelf when these things happen and implement it again. That is a diversion, however, from the basic work and duties and responsibilities given to our many units of the federal government every time this happens. That is a diminution of the services and support that is provided to the constituencies out there, and that's you. That is one effect. That is one effect of these continuing attempts, successful attempts, if you will, to kick the can down the street without establishing under the Constitution a real and viable budget that tells us how we're going to operate for the future. That uncertainty is also a cause for great angst and great uncertainty and great inefficiency inside all of our agencies. There's more with respect to this particular movement, kicking this can down the street a few weeks into January. So what does this all have to do with what happened, the short-term spending bill that was just passed by the Congress, the House, and the Senate just this past week? Well, I'm going to focus in particular upon the Department of Justice because I know that best, although this kind of thing applies across the board to virtually every other federal unit, agency of government. We know because we have seen what the Congress has passed, this stopgap measure. It includes a 12% cut, a 12% cut in funding for, yes, that's right, federal prosecutors. That number was almost one-fifth lower than what the Department of Justice, what the Attorney General Merrick Garland had said it needed. Soon after the January 6th event in 2021, when the agency was said it was preparing to handle an increasing number of cases and defendants related to that incidence of domestic terrorism, we know all that well. A Congress at that time upped the funding for federal prosecutors for the U.S. Department of Justice to about $2.8 billion with a B. And yes, I know that sounds like a lot of money. It supports a huge number of things out there that happen every single year to keep us all safe and secure. Last year, however, as these budget disputes continue to happen, that fell to about $2.6 billion. And now it appears that coming out of this most recent budget plan, that's down to $2.3 billion over the next year, a reduction that will likely mean hundreds of fewer cases, prosecutors available out there to do the basic work of the nation. And as anyone who spends some time talking about law enforcement, as we do on this broadcast, we know well that trials are costly. They cost money. They come out of the federal budget, not just in money, but also, once again, in time. Defendants in these cases have a legitimate right to a speedy trial under something called the Speedy Trial Act. We've talked about that at great length as well. And all of those things handled by not only prosecutors, defense counsel, who can credibly argue that their clients are being denied due process when those rights are not observed, and also the courts themselves, which don't benefit from these kinds of things as well. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this impact of this latest attempt to not adopt a budget, but adopt this stopgap measure, its effect on our government, and the ways in which we should respond to that as we go ahead in our nation's work.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin. In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. The biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip has been mostly evacuated, says CBS's Imtiaz Tayeb.
Dozens of critically ill people, including a number of premature babies who cannot leave, will remain there with a handful of doctors and carers.
Israel denies claims that it ordered people to leave the hospital. A state judge in Colorado says Donald Trump's name can appear on the presidential primary ballot. KCNC-TV's Alan Janay.
Donald Trump's campaign said this is another nail in the coffin of the un-American ballot challenges.
Rain will fall in some parts of the country the first few days of Thanksgiving week, says National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec.
It's going to impact areas from the plains on Monday and then pressing eastward into the Midwest on Tuesday and then late Tuesday into Wednesday along the East Coast. So it's going to impact a lot of people.
Parts of upstate New York could get freezing rain or heavy snow on Wednesday into Thanksgiving Day. CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
The Bucks with a victory in Charlotte. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks turning up the heat in the fourth quarter to win 131-99 over the Hornets. Giannis, back after taking a night off with a sore calf muscle, scored 16 points. Damian Lillard with 27. And all seven Bucks players with double-digit scoring over the Hornets. Head coach Adrian Griffin.
You know, I love how we shared the ball and moved the ball and looking for each other. That's something that we've been stressing the last probably week or so. Just a fun way to play. And I think Giannis really spearheaded that. You know, you start spraying around. We're getting open shots. And they trust each other. You know, Pat was, I think, 1-for-6 in the first half. And then Giannis starts feeding them and, you know, making just unselfish plays. And, you know, it's just so good for the spirit of the team. You know, it was just a total team effort on both ends.
That's the Bucks head coach Adrian Griffin with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
With weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and a high near 52. Mostly clear tonight, 27. Sunny with a high near 50 on your Sunday. For Monday, a chance of rain with a high around 45. For Tuesday, a chance of rain, breezy, with a high around 39.
Right now, 35.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over, then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt US Kids, and the Ad Council.
From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
Welcome back to our Saturday morning broadcast. It is Saturday, November 18th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel. We're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Also taking your written comments, especially your inquiries online. Go to the Civic Media website, your broadcast station, find that there. Pull down the Morning Cannoli folder and send us a note. Anya and I would be delighted to hear from you. We're talking this morning about the rule of law once again. We're going to go overseas for some significant reporting coming from two major African nations and also coming from Great Britain. Both of these stories, all the stories we're talking about this morning in both this first hour and, yes, our second 10 o'clock hour this morning, all of them having unmistakable lessons, lines to be drawn between these stories and things going on in our own nation when it comes to justice and the administration of law. Let's talk about the first of those having to do with Great Britain and the nation of Rwanda. Britain's Supreme Court, acting much like our court does, that is making final decisions about cases, controversies, both criminal and civil, same kind of function, different apparatus, different tradition there, but same kind of function. Britain's Supreme Court just this past week, found, ruled, determined that a policy, a government policy by the ruling party, that is the Conservative Party, in power in Great Britain, that's a policy to deport asylum seekers to the nation of Rwanda from Great Britain. You probably recall this story from weeks, maybe in months, maybe in years ago. It's a major blow to this conservative government that has long described this plan of taking asylum seekers who were arriving on the shores of Great Britain, crossing in small boats from France and other places, crossing the English Channel and arriving there. Well, the prime minister, his name is Rishi Sunak, adopting what was first proposed by a prior prime minister, his name Boris Johnson, way back in April of 2022. This proposal, once again, as they said, to so-called take back control of Britain's borders. Does that sound familiar? Take back control of the borders. The plan to send many, if not all, of these asylum seekers, again, fearful of what would happen to them in their countries of origin, coming to Great Britain, seeking asylum, just as asylum seekers do in our nation. The government there proposing and putting together a plan, actually spending £140 million already. That's about $175 million, U.S. dollars, to implement this plan to transport members of these asylum seeker groups, individuals, groups of people to Rwanda, this South Central nation. This past week, the Justice Robert Reed, one of the five judges who was determining whether or not this particular policy, much like our Supreme Court does, is consistent with basic fundamental rules and regulations, standards of practice, human rights, civil rights, said that the position of the government cannot stand. He found that an earlier court of appeals decision, a lower court decision there in the nation of Great Britain, that Rwanda was not safe for refugees. The court, Justice Robert Reed, saying, we agree with their conclusion. He emphasized along the way that the plan would breach both British and international law, invoking both of those things. And again, this comes as a major blow to the Conservative Party, including the leadership now in the hands of Rishi Sunak, who is the Prime Minister of Great Britain. All of this comes amidst controversy in Great Britain, not unknown to our own nation, about asylum seekers and how we process, how we handle their legitimate claims, how we determine whether they are legitimate or not, and determine through a humanitarian, focused, and decent way of dealing with all human beings their applications for asylum in our nation. In this case, in Great Britain, the Supreme Court there saying you cannot pack them up and send them off to Rwanda. Here's specifically what Justice Reed said. He said there were substantial grounds for believing that these asylum seekers who had their claims heard in Rwanda would face what's called refoulement, R-E-F-O-U-L-E-M-E-N-T, a word we don't talk about a lot here in this nation, but a concept out there. It basically means that genuine refugees could be returned to their countries of origin, places from which they are fleeing, where they would face potential violence or even ill treatment in violation, once again, of both the international and British law
that Justice Reed was talking about. The judge added that while some proper protections may be put in place in the future, in other words, inviting the possibility of return of this plan to the Supreme Court, he said they, meaning the government officials, have not yet shown that those mechanisms, those protections are in place right now. He took time along the way to explain the court's ruling did not rest only upon the European Convention on Human Rights, an international agreement that Britain and others helped draft after World War I. But he also noted that the legal principle of non-refoulement, he noted, was a part of the United Nations Refugee Convention, to which the UK is also a party, as well as the UN Convention Against Torture and other international treaties out there that Britain has ratified. Needless to say, the Rishi Sunak government responding to this in the halls of government, in the House of Commons, to great concern, to great raucous debate just this past week. Rishi Sunak promising to renew this program, putting it back together. Meanwhile, the nation of Rwanda coming forth and saying, we do take issue with the ruling that Rwanda is not safe, that it's not a safe third country for asylum seekers and refugees. The country representative says that they're committed to its international obligations. Again, huge payments made, but it's not going ahead right now. Why? Because the Supreme Court of Great Britain has determined it's inconsistent with, yes, British law, with international law. Again, a lesson for us in America about the rule of law right here when it comes to treatment of all of us, all human beings on the face of this planet, citizens, residents alike, and those people who would seek asylum in our nation, in nations where they are, from which they are fleeing oppression, violence, and threats of that. Significant case coming out of UK just this past week. Let's stay in the continent of Africa and talk about yet another nation there called Zimbabwe, also the source of a lot of historical information and calamity from years past. Just this past week, matters related to what is not only the political disruption there, but now the violent disruption of inter-party relations there. An activist in Zimbabwe's main opposition party was found dead, on the side of a road in the capital there called Harare. Police reports confirming that. Party spokesman for the party, that is this party called the Citizens Coalition for Change, said he had been abducted while he was campaigning in a local election over the past weekend. The attackers apparently stopped this individual. His name was Tafumi Masaya. He is a pastor, 51 years old. He was campaigning door to door on Saturday to promote a candidate along with other members of the political party that he was in favor of. That's called, again, the Citizens Coalition for Change. Multiple SUVs pulled up. Attackers jumped out and chased him and another of his companions, also campaigning on the streets of Harare this past weekend. When Masaya stopped to help some fellow activists who had fallen, he was a disabled person who had a disability there. The attackers apparently pounced on him. They beat him and the other person took them away in separate vehicles. Eventually, they dropped off the activist with the disability. They left him alive on the side of the road, and he did survive this attack, but not the same can be said for Tafumi Masaya. His body was discovered on Sunday, his body disfigured by slashes of a machete along the side of a road. Now, why is this significant? Well, it's significant because Mr. Masaya's death has raised, again, this great alarm about actions being taken, arguably, although denied by the present government there, to attack, to stop political opposition in that nation. In fact, at least four members of this same party, the Citizens Coalition for Change, have been killed since just last year. Four members very active in the political arena there in Zimbabwe. Masaya was the fourth party member to have been abducted and tortured over the past 2 months alone. And again, although three of those survived, the significance of the messaging, whatever it is, wherever it comes from, is unmistakably clear. One of those people who was abducted was named Katuzi Nagaziari. He was a member of the parliament there. He posted a video in which he was shown being abducted. He was seen in a suit and tie, breathing heavily. A man wearing a cap with a Mercedes logo on it, carrying a rifle, rushes toward him, and then the footage ends. All these things happening in Zimbabwe. Now, to be clear, the president of Zimbabwe, his name is Emmerson Mnangagwa, and his governing party, the ZANU-PF, all of this in Zimbabwe, have denied any involvement, have said they have nothing to do with Mr. Messiah's death or these other acts of domestic terrorism happening right now in that nation. The opposition, the president said, would plainly be given an opportunity to voice their views. Nothing of this is the product, they maintain, of the political attempts to try to stop political opponents there in Zimbabwe. We do know, however, that the governing party, the ZANU-PF party, led by the president, Mnangagwa, did receive, arguably, a majority of the votes back in August. But during the course of that voting, during that election there in that African nation, huge amount of doubts about whether or not that voting was proper. Both regional, domestic, and even international viewers, observers of that election, voicing the view that the election itself was skewed, election itself not premised upon an accurate count, leading once again to members of the opposing party, the Citizens Coalition, to advocate for change. And in the midst of this very violent activity, an awful lot of people wondering whether or not the government itself, the presidency of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, might be responsible. Again, they denied it, and they have the right to do that. Investigations underway by international and domestic entities to try to figure out what is going on there. But once again, news about violence being exhibited, being visited upon people in the political arena. This is the last thing, the last kind of thing that can be tolerated in a republic, in a democracy where voting takes place. We not only embrace, but we promote the notion of advocacy in all aspects. We have in this nation not only the First Amendment, the right to assemble, the right to speak, but the right to engage in political discourse, the right to oppose nonviolently, the positions of people in authority and responsibility. When four and five people in a political party in opposition to that in power are either found dead or beaten severely, abducted, and the message is sent to them and others like them that if you engage in this kind of political advocacy, bad things will happen to you, that is completely contrary not only to what Zimbabwe has been about, supposedly been about in recent years, like all nations on the face of the planet, including the United States, emphasizes and promotes the notion of public discourse in the political campaigns, in the political arena, absent violence. Another lesson for us here in America. Another lesson also about the threats to people who would voice opposing views to the existing government, but views that are contrary even inside the political campaigns going on there in Zimbabwe, but also, of course, right here in the United States of America. We embrace that, and we embrace it without the kind of retribution that we have probably seen just in these past weeks, certainly this past week, past weeks and months in the nation of Zimbabwe. Lessons for us here in the rule of law and the administration of justice, the delivery of government functions, properly understanding that advocacy and diversity in voice is a good thing. Let's come back to the United States of America and talk about two other cases that also underscore the importance of the rule of law in our nation. These going on in the trial courts, the federal trial courts of our great country. First, let's talk about this. A federal jury, again, this is not a grand jury, as we've talked about before. This is a trial jury, sometimes called a petit jury. People assembled, brought in, as many of you probably have been brought into the state and federal courts of our land, brought in to determine whether or not the government has established proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the offense conduct alleged in the indictment. In this particular case, a federal grand jury just this past week convicted the defendant who was accused of the violent hammer attack against Paul Pelosi at his home and the home of former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco just last year, October 28th of 2022. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the meaning of the conviction of David DePape for that horrific violent crime, what that means for the rule of law, what that means for him, the deterrent impact of that upon him and hopefully upon anyone who would engage in that kind of physical violent conduct here in our nation.
Nine. 93.5 The Tap.
What do you mean he's not coming in? This is our busiest time.
The mixologist at Claude's Bar is moving to Manhattan.
I'm already down two bar backs. No one's manning front of
house. Now he needs an equally cosmopolitan replacement.
How am I going to find a new bartender before New Year's Eve?
Indeed can help him hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Instant Match instantly connects you with quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
You probably heard the quote, friends are family you choose. It's also the idea behind the other Thanksgiving holiday, Friendsgiving. Some credit shows, like Friends, for starting this trend by featuring a day meant to celebrate with those who aren't your relatives. And when to gather is up to you. Many celebrate just before Thanksgiving, while others wait until after the official holiday. However you celebrate, all of us with your local Civic Media radio station wish you a wonderful holiday season. I'm Terry Barr.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome back to our Saturday morning broadcast, talking now about two major jury determinations, or at least in one case, a jury determination having to do with the administration of justice in our federal district courts, trial courts. Right before the break, talking about the conviction of David DePape. You remember him well from some of the videos, a lot of the reporting way back in October of last year, when Paul Pelosi, the husband, the spouse of the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, taken in his home and a home invasion. The reporting there, obviously a part of the record now of the history of our nation. The entry, the forced entry by David DePape into that home late at night, summoning the spouse of Nancy Pelosi, Paul Pelosi, from his bed. He comes down from his bedroom, and there is video. There is video showing what nearly happened there, which could have been a fatality there. In fact, what happens is that DePape enters the home. He is wielding, he's unmistakably wielding a violent weapon. It's a hammer. And as the police eventually arrive, as the two of them, David DePape and the person who's the victim of this crime, Paul Pelosi, are struggling, the police come upon the scene. And the police tell both individuals to put the weapon down, drop the hammer. And, of course, Paul Pelosi does exactly what the police direct him to do. David DePape does not, and is in that moment again caught on videotape by the police that Paul Pelosi is stricken in the head by David DePape. And it's upon that basis that he is charged both in federal and state court for that violent attack. Just this past week, a jury finds him guilty. They began deliberating Wednesday afternoon before reaching a verdict late Thursday morning. Took them just a matter of hours, finding him guilty of federal counts involving the attack upon Paul Pelosi. While on the stand during the course of the trial that preceded this jury verdict of just this past week, DePape said he went to the home to talk to Representative Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi at the time, about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And he maintains during the course of the trial that the husband, Paul Pelosi, was never my target, he said. He actually said on the stand, I'm sorry that he got hurt. I reacted, David DePape said, because my plan was basically ruined. During the course of all of this, Paul Pelosi also testifying about the fear that he had when David DePape came upon him in the house with the hammer in one hand, some twist ties in the other, repeatedly asking, where's Nancy? Paul Pelosi testifying, I recognized that I was in some serious danger, so I tried to stay as calm as I possibly could. Once again, the footage showing the attack after the police tell them both to drop the hammer. During the course of all of this presentation by the federal government, it also becomes clear that David DePape, not only there to inflict some very serious violence upon the Pelosis, Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi. During the course of all of this, evidence suggesting strongly that David DePape, one of these conspiracy theorists who buys into all sorts of unsupported and factually bankrupt statements about the legitimacy, the illegitimacy of elections generally, there, during the course of all of this, he indicates during the course of the investigation, during this prosecution generally, that he was there, he was going to hold Nancy hostage, Nancy Pelosi hostage, and talk to her. That's one of the things he said to investigators at the time. He said if she told the truth about these elections, other things that are on his mind, he said he would let her go. And if she lied, he was going to break her kneecaps. That's the kind of thing that David DePape said prior to the return of the verdict, finding him guilty for the assault, the attack that landed Paul Pelosi in the hospital for a number of days. Thankfully, he survived that attack and returned home, once again suggesting the importance not only of prosecutions that identify people who would mistakenly rely upon the misinformation, the things that are posted online that are patently untrue, and would attempt to take into their own hands, did it take into his own hands, violence against our political leadership and the spouses of them. Under federal law, it's a crime both to attack or attempt to attack political leaders and the spouses, the family members of those people. Those are the counts upon which David DePape was found guilty just this past week. Sending once again this all-important message of deterrence as to him. He will be in prison for a very long time based upon the sentencing guidelines, that sentencing coming up at some point in the weeks and months ahead. Also sending once again an indication, a deterrent message to other people who would be out there that if you do this to our elected officials, regardless of the side of the political aisle that you are on, Democrat, Republican, somewhere in between, it doesn't matter. We do not engage in this country, not without impact upon our lives, not without a response by our law enforcement entities, both state and federal, to this kind of thing. If you decide you're going to engage in this, if you're going to rely upon the misinformation, not making the attempt to find out what the truth is about facts that are out there, and instead you act with violence, you will be on the receiving end of indictments, and yes, indeed, you'll be incarcerated by our government. The single most significant thing any government can do to any of our residents, any of our citizens, incarcerating you for the violent behaviors you have undertaken, that's the deterrent impact upon this particular defendant, David DePape, the general deterrence upon our community generally. Another trial also just finished this past week, this one in Louisville. And this one not coming to the decisive resolution that we saw just this past week in that California jury verdict coming out of the federal court in that venue. The prosecution of Brett Hankinson, who's a former police detective who fired 10 bullets through Breonna Taylor's apartment during that fatal 2020 raid in Louisville, Kentucky. You recall her well. Her name, of course, affiliated with civil rights responses, finding in the public domain and also in the prosecution domain on behalf of the Department of Justice, state officials as well, finding that the response of police officers to the events that were presented to a magistrate judge inappropriate, violative of our federal and state civil rights laws. What happened this past week? A trial prosecution of one of the many police officers there in Louisville and federal charges related to this fatal police raid that happened again at Breonna Taylor's home in 2020. The case itself, unlike the situation in California as to David DePape, this case ends in mistrial. Why? Because the jury comes back and it says they cannot determine beyond a reasonable doubt among the 12 of them unanimously whether or not a verdict should be found either acquitting him completely or finding him guilty of some or all of the counts, the federal criminal civil rights charges brought by the U.S. Department of Justice. Significant, this is the second time that Mr. Hankinson has gone to trial on charges related to the case and avoided a conviction. When we come back after the top of this hour, we'll talk more about the implications of that and then move on to other cases involving trials and proceedings in the federal and state courts.
Tell a friend what's on tap. There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley. This is 93.5 The Tap. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz. The Israeli military this morning is denying claims.